It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the number of stay-at-home moms is on the rise lately after sharp declines over the years. It may be a matter of necessity, not of choice. We'll find out why in about 10 minutes.
First, do statistics paint an accurate picture when it comes to the link between race and crime, and how do we correctly interpret the high arrest rates of black males?
Khalil Gibran Muhammad has done extensive research on the historic links between blackness and criminality and questions how accurate these perceptions are. He's the director of the New York Public Library's Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture and author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. He joins us from the New York Public Library. Khalil, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Well, you say African Americans have been stigmatized as criminals since the end of slavery. What do you believe causes that perception or misperception?
Well, the context of slavery created a universe of ideas that essentially dehumanized black people. In fact, the entire infrastructure of slavery depended upon black people being less than equal to whites. And so that set of ideas didn't change just because chattel slavery ended. But our modern concepts of black people as criminals are not so much tied to the universe of ideas about black people as former savages in Africa, but in fact tied to a set of statistical artifacts such as higher rates of incarceration or arrests, which are themselves directly linked to our political economy, the way in which resources are distributed in society.
Well, there's an argument that you've spent a lot of time arguing against. I'll lay it out in a brief nutshell. It goes, black people are more likely to be arrested for crimes, convicted of crimes, put in jail for crimes. The criminal problem in the United States is a black problem in the United States, mainly a black urban problem. How do you respond to that basic thesis?
Well, the basic thesis, again, is attached to this very long history. Let me give you the counter-narrative examples. At the moment of which we first start to have these national discussions about black people as criminals, which is about 100 years old, there were far more white people incarcerated and arrested in our nation's prisons outside of the Jim Crow South, outside of places like Mississippi and Texas, so on and so forth. And that was a conversation that essentially turned on whether or not those people were wired to criminality or whether they had been victimized by class inequality or what was then called industrialization. And so the statistics were less the focus of attention than was the need to rebuild those communities, to provide constructive forms of leisure, to provide outlets for play, to create child labor laws, to make sure that families were not subject to the exploitative demands of the economy. And that system went into place in the Progressive Era, went into place in the New Deal, helped to underwrite the greatest expansion of college going through the GI Bill, et cetera, all over 8 decades of intervention, starting with the problem of white-on-white or white ethnic crime and violence in our nation's biggest cities. African Americans, who are always in the picture, were essentially left out of the responses. Their statistics became an excuse for not actually building a social safety net, for not allowing them to live in the same Levitt towns and white picket fence neighborhoods as was being built for working class whites after the Great Depression and the beginning of the post-World War II period.
So you're saying when there was a perceived problem with white criminality, the answer was, what do we do to change conditions? When there's a perceived problem with black criminality, the answer is different. It's what?
Well, let's make sure that we lock up as many as we can, and let's make sure that they stay in a limited geographical space as a matter of public safety because they pose a public threat to us. This was the logic of the Jim Crow period. It's why we had a lynching era that lasted well into the civil rights movement. And it's why in places like New York City, only till quite recently, we had effective racial discriminatory or racial profiling policies like stop and frisk. And I'll just give you one example. For the population of New Yorkers who are 14 to 18 and are black, it represents 125,000 young people. But of that group, 177,000 were subject to stop, question, and frisk practices. Why? Because those young people are presumptively suspicious in New York City and were being asked for their identification while found on the streets of various high-crime communities in the city. So those are very different responses. One is punitive, and one is compassionate. One is about an economic intervention. One is about a criminal justice response.
Does being treated as a criminal or a potential criminal anyway make someone more prone eventually to engage in criminal behavior?
Well, I'm not a social scientist. I'm a historian, so I tend to avoid the predictive analysis. I would say that the tangle of predisposing criminogenic factors are so complicated that much of what we do with regard to our criminal justice policies are themselves antisocial, which is to say that we actually need pro-social policies that we know worked in the past, we know that were directed towards non-black communities, and ultimately created the world's biggest middle class in this country. So why is it that we use statistics essentially to reinforce the stigma that begins with slavery and essentially justifies levels of inequality that are persistent and enduring in our country?
In your book, Condemnation of Blackness, you make the case, among other things, that this notion of black criminality was a big part of the creation of what we now know as our modern urban centers. Can you explain the connection?
Well, yes. One of the ways to think about this is a place like Chicago or Milwaukee or Philadelphia or Detroit are places that carry the proud history of being modern and civilized. These were the industrial centers of this nation, helped to make America as great as she is. These are also places that were assumed to be liberal and race-friendly, places that had sacrificed sons and daughters on behalf of the Civil War. And yet, it's precisely in those places that our modern constructs and ideas about black people as criminals were actually born. It's not for nothing that it's the state of Wisconsin, for example, that has within the top three highest rates of black incarceration rates as compared to, say, Mississippi. So out of a population per 100,000 in Wisconsin, there's 4,416 black people, according to recent Bureau of Justice Statistics data, as compared to Mississippi, where that comparative number is 1,742, or Alabama, where it's 1,916. We actually perfected the logic of a punitive response to black inequality using crime statistics as symptomatic of black inferiority in places outside of the South. That's where today we can have, again, in a post-civil rights context, huge racial disparities in places that are ostensibly racially liberal, when in fact it is tied to this self-reinforcing justification that there's something wrong with those people because of their high rates of criminality and imprisonment, and not something wrong with society.
And I think I read somewhere you said that these northern urban centers were used as kind of an aha. This wasn't a place where we had slavery. It wasn't a place where we had Jim Crow. We still have these higher crime rates among blacks. Therefore, you know, it isn't a structural problem. It isn't a societal problem.
That's right. So the longstanding logic and idea in our country that only in the South does racism truly reside has been one of the longest running stories that we tell ourselves. And certainly in this 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Movement, we continue to hear these terrible stories of all of the things that happened in the Jim Crow period, from bull Connors, German shepherds, to the firemen's hoses, to the ways in which people disappeared in the still of the night, only to be found at the bottom of the Tallahatchie River. Well, as it turns out, in terms of policing of black communities and the origins of segregation in the North, it wasn't this de jure form of racism, but it was in the bureaucratic forms and the ways in which black communities were actually policed and quarantined. For example, in places like Chicago, when you had early race riots, which were generally white attacks on the black community, police stood not to serve and protect the victims of those race riots, but in fact to assist and aid mob violence against blacks. They were police officers, not just citizens, protecting the boundaries of what were white communities in the urban North in the name of public safety and the threat that early black migrants posed to those places. And you see this across the North. Yet the mythology that wasn't about racism, that there was no systematic coordinated campaign to keep black people in their place, as it turns out, historians have done 30 years of research on this, turns out to just simply not be true.
You're a historian. I won't ask you to predict the future, but you're working in part to prescribe some ideas to change the future. What would you like to see be different in terms of the way we think and the way we legislate?
Well, I'd like to see us not think that we can talk about black people's crime statistics as if it's post-racial, that it's colorblind, that the language and the discourse that we use to say that black people have a crime problem grows precisely out of the soil of white supremacy in the late 19th century. We really can't have it both ways. And although we try to do that, either our Southern kin from back in the day, from back in the 1900s, were racist or they weren't. And if they were racist, so too are we participating in the same language of racism, which is that black people have a crime problem. We could reverse the narrative. And the way that that looks is it looks like methamphetamine addiction in rural America. It looks like heroin addiction in the northeast region of this country in places like Vermont and New Hampshire, which is not a rhetoric in a discourse about criminals running loose high on drugs. It is a rhetoric of a breakdown in the social fabric of those communities where people who are out of work, who are struggling to live up to their own expectations, turn to self-destructive behaviors, and in this case, drugs. The vast majority of black people are in prison most recently in the context of mass incarceration for nonviolent drug offenses. We have always had underground economies that work to the advantage of underemployed men, whether they were Italian gangsters of the 1920s or African Americans of the 1980s. And yet only with African Americans do we have the ongoing continued stigmatization of the entire race as somehow pathological. Paul Ryan himself, a Wisconsinite, is continuing this in this tradition. We've got to stop that. We've got to start to socialize the conversation about inequality and crime in our country and see it as a call to action on all of our parts, from government to private enterprise to faith leaders, to community activists, that all of our children matter on these questions. And this is not a way to say, well, I don't want to have anything to do with that until those people help themselves. That's precisely the same logic and the articulation of difference and stigma that was applied over 100 years ago.
Khalil, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
That was Khalil Gibran Muhammad, director of the New York Public Library's Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, author of The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. A new report out from the Pew Research Center this week finds that the number of stay-at-home mothers is increasing after decades of decline.
In 2012, 29% of all mothers with children under the age of 18 stayed at home, a figure that has steadily risen since 1999, when only 23% of mothers were stay-at-home. So what's behind the shift?
Joining us now to talk about these findings is Barbara Rissman, professor and head of the sociology department at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She's also a senior scholar at the Council on Contemporary Families. Barbara, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So this number of stay-at-home moms, after dropping a lot over the years, is starting to go back up. First, is this a surprising finding for you?
I think what's surprising to me is the headlines and the way it's been in the news today. Because actually, although the numbers are going up, when you actually look a little closer at what the mothers say, 6% of the mothers in this study say they're at home because they can't find a job. So if they're at home, and so when you take those six out, we're really very flat. So I think that part of the story, probably most of the story here, is that it's harder to find a job that allows you to work and covers your child care, particularly if you're have less education. And your earning capacity is not very high.
Yeah, a lot of times when there's reporting on this kind of issue, it focuses on maybe upper middle class women who are making the decision whether to work or be at home. This change is not that really at all. It's do you have a choice in the first place?
Right. In fact, the percentage of women who are educated with college and above college education that stays home has continued to fall. And while they're sometimes called the opt-out mothers, I think it's more accurate really to call them the pushed-out mothers, because they're women in the kinds of jobs and married to men in the kinds of jobs that are far more than 40 or 50 hours a week. And those kinds of jobs have not, 24/7 professional jobs have only increased the demands on workers. And so that two-parent families where they're both working those kind of hours don't make it almost impossible or make it very hard to also be parents. So that, in fact, what we have in this study really is good evidence that where once upon a time the stay-at-home mom was kind of a privileged elite, well-educated, married woman. Stay-at-home moms now are more likely to be less educated and not be able to earn enough money to make it worthwhile to go into the labor force.
It's a state for a lot of the people we're talking about, maybe where the job they would get wouldn't pay enough to cover the child care they would need while going to that job. Am I right?
That's absolutely the case. And this new Pew Research document also suggests that mothers who are immigrants are less likely to be in the labor force. So they also, many of them also have the language barrier.
So there's been a lot of talk about a wider crisis of people with maybe a high school level of education or maybe a little technical school having a harder time finding jobs or at least having a harder time finding decent paid jobs. Is this story of these stay-at-home moms just part of that wider story, do you think?
Absolutely. I think this story is very much a part of that wider story, which is it's hard enough to find low-wage jobs, but to find low-wage jobs that pay enough to replace the care and the, you know, how much it would cost to cover someone to take care of your kids, then it's a lot harder. And I think that's really the story that jumps out in this new Pew Research is the demographic trends that the new stay-at-home mom isn't really a privileged white woman. She's more likely to be an underprivileged woman of color who can't afford can't find a job that can cover the costs of her child care.
I've also seen issues, especially in lower wage jobs, of predictability. What I mean by that is where some people can expect to work from 9 to 5 Monday through Friday or some other regular schedule. A lot of lower wage jobs at fast food restaurants, hotel cleaning, that sort of thing, you might be on call for a day and not know if you need to go into work and thus need childcare until the night or even the morning of the job.
I think that's absolutely the case, and I think that even more common than that in those kinds of jobs is that it's structured in such a way that you get your hours every week, say on Wednesday. So you might know for the next 7 days, but it changes every week. And that, too, if that's the kind of job available to you, that's a really hard schedule to try to find someone who's going to take care of your child or children on that kind of rotating weekly basis.
Looking at the numbers of the moms we're talking about, the stay-at-home moms, how many of them do we know are single parents and how many of them have a breadwinner, albeit possibly one with a lower wage job?
I think I'm going to look this up for you, but I think that most of the we still have the majority of women who are stay-at-home moms to a breadwinning father, but the numbers of single moms has gone up to about 40%. Yeah, 41% are now. So those, and the other thing about being a single mom these days is they're far more likely to be in poverty than married mothers. So that's, if you're at home, you're far more likely to be raising children in poverty. And that really is quite a different perspective than the traditional leave it to beaver sort of view of a stay-at-home mom.
Do you think this is largely an untold story in our culture, maybe mainly in our media?
I do. I really think it's an untold story because when people who are writing for mainstream publications hear the word stay-at-home mom, they think of women who have been professional doctors and lawyers and decide they have a baby and they're not going to go back into the labor force. And that's what the word calls forth, I think, in our stereotypes. And what this research, this is not the first research that started to show that there's been a flip on who stays home when they have children, but it's certainly the newest and the most nationally representative research on this, that we have a flip in what it means and to be a stay-at-home mom. And now for not all, but most, it's really about not being able to earn enough wages or have enough stability in one's schedule to find reasonable childcare.
We're talking with sociologist Barbara Rissman of the University of Illinois Chicago about the new Pew Center research on the increase in stay-at-home moms over the last decade, largely pegged to economic necessity, not to personal choice. And we want to hear from you.
We're talking about the rise of stay-at-home moms. A new report out this week shows that the number of stay-at-home mothers is increasing after decades of decline. Our guest is Barbara Rissman, professor and head of sociology at the University of Illinois at Chicago.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Are you a stay-at-home mom? If so, was it a conscious choice you made, or, like a lot of the people accounting for that increase, did the economy force your hand? Is it because there isn't a job you can get or that pays well enough to justify getting it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post over at the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Katie on the line in Green Bay. Katie, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just calling, listening to your program, and I'm a stay-at-home mother, and I don't really fall into the categories that she had been discussing. I am educated. I had a wonderful job, and I left because I didn't feel like I would have the balance between family life and professional life. I thought I'd be torn into many different directions to do a good job at either one. And I just find it frustrating as a professional that there aren't part-time work opportunities as a professional out there. And I just wondered if your guest had any research or any information to share on that, on the lack of part-time opportunities.
Katie, thanks for calling. Another kind of category, someone who wants to work part-time while being mostly a stay-at-home parent. Barbara, do you think that's a common story?
I absolutely do. I think that, in fact, the research shows that most of the professionally educated stay-at-home moms who are often called opt-out moms are really pushed-out moms, like this the person who just called, which is they'd like to keep their hand in their profession. They'd like part-time work for when their children are small and the high-impact parts of parenting, but that's not how our working workforce operates, that it's either all or nothing. And I think that this all or nothing paradigm is really a historical, it's a legacy of a history of where mostly families were breadwinning men and stay-at-home moms who, when they married and had children, that was it. They were removed themselves from the labor force for the rest of their lives. Now, all people, mothers and fathers as well, have high-impact parts of their lives where their kids are young and they want to have more flexibility to be spend less time in the labor force. And then they have, then their children are older and that's gone and they want to be back in the labor force. And so, but our society is still mindlessly plugging along as if there were two kinds of people, those who earn a living and those who take care of children, when in fact more and more men and women, mostly women, but we're moving more that men feel the same kind of crunch where they actually are going to spend their lives being both breadwinners and parents, and they want more flexibility to do both. And we push them out of the labor force some, if that's what they want at this time. And I think we feel it at the individual level, but we have to change our workplaces and even our legal system, our regulations, so that companies can't really discriminate against people who want to pull back for periods of their lives and not give it all.
Katie, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Well, Barbara, I've also seen coverage of employment trends lately saying that one of the things that makes it really hard to get a job is having not had a job for a long period of time. So say the people we're talking about, maybe they've had to stay home from birth through the time the kid goes to school. Does that make it harder for them to reenter the workforce even when they have the time and schedule flexibility to do so?
Oh, absolutely. When women, the sad part is that when women do stay home for just a few years, it impacts their entire, not only career, but lifetime earnings. They never catch up for to where they would have been if they hadn't taken that time off. And so that there's a presumption that you have to make a career in a straight beeline without any bumps and curves. And I think that that presumption, once again, falls back to the sort of unconscious bias that we presume that people are either ideal workers and don't have anything in their life but their work 24/7, or their mothers. And in fact, in this day and age, people mix it up in all sorts of ways, but our society, our businesses, our government has yet to catch up with the way people are living their lives or trying.
Let's go back to our callers now. We've got Angie on the line in Milwaukee. Angie, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you? I was just calling in because I have a bit of a unique situation. I haven't really met too many people that have it, but I mean, I semi-chose to stay out of to leave the workforce after having a child. And it really had more to do with the fact that my husband was not supportive of having our son in childcare of any kind whatsoever. So I think that's another reason maybe why some women decide not to, is just they're not comfortable with the childcare options, or they don't have a supportive spouse that is supportive of their career. And as far as the things that I find to be the most challenging as far as leaving the workforce is, I think that in a lot of ways, the stereotype is actually flipped of the stay-at-home mom. It's, you know, I think more people treat me more like I'm stupid than anything else. Like, you know, why would you give up your career for this? And, you know, so on and so forth. The challenging part for me is the lack of adult interaction on a daily basis and the lack of, you know, seemingly quantifiable challenges. So I think,
Angie, thanks a lot for the call, and I can sympathize. I was a work-at-home parent for a while, and I did miss interacting with grown-ups from time to time. But Angie makes the case, Barbara, in addition to being locked into the stay-at-home situation, she feels stigmatized for being a stay-at-home mom.
Well, I think that she really put her finger on a real social phenomenon, which is that back in the day when most kids had stay-at-home moms, stay-at-home moms weren't lonely because their friends were all also around all day to get together with, take the kids to the park, to have play dates, and so that as fewer and fewer children actually have stay-at-home moms, and right now only 1 in 5 American children are being raised by a stay-at-home mother. So those women, in fact, don't have a natural peer group in their communities, in their neighborhoods. It also is part of the reason we're having fewer and fewer successes of organizations that depend on the volunteer labor of women who are outside of the labor force, or stay-at-home moms. So I think that the issue for women who are at home with their children is to somehow hook up in maybe even a meetup group, but in organizations where there are other women or men, parents at home during the day, so that they get together and have some adult interaction. Because I think that that used to happen naturally, but it doesn't happen naturally anymore when only 20% of American children have mothers who are, or fathers who are, outside of the labor force.
Barbara, you've mentioned a couple times that our legal system, our corporate structures haven't caught up with the needs, especially of these lower income moms who are staying at home and don't have a lot of prospects for good paying jobs. Briefly, what is a change or two you would like to see?
One thing I'd like to see is the ability of any paid worker to go from full to part-time for short periods of high-intense family responsibility times, family responsibility, so that people can keep their jobs at the same rate of pay, although perhaps cut to 3/4, to give people at high moments of family labor the ability to hold on to the job that they have without having to work the same number of hours. And that would be a first step. It's not the full answer. I'd also like to see high quality, affordable child care available for everyone, so that no one has to choose between having a job or making sure their kids are taken well care of, because no one, myself included, would choose to work in the paid labor force if it meant I didn't think my child was going to do well. And so those are the two things that I would, two baby steps I would like to our society to take in the next few years.
Barbara, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Barbara Rissman. She's professor and head of sociology at the University of Illinois at Chicago and a senior scholar at the Council on Contemporary Families. She joined us to talk about new research showing stay-at-home moms are on the rise. Every now and then, a neuroscience story makes a big splash in the media for demonstrating fundamental differences between the brains of men and women, including one late last year suggesting that men's brains were hardwired for tasks like map reading, while women are wired for more intuitive styles of thinking.
Our next guest wants the worlds of science and the media to be more cautious and not be so quick to decide that men and women are wired differently. Virginia Hughes is a science journalist, and her blog, Only Human, is hosted by National Geographic magazine. Virginia, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So why is it so tempting to us reading these articles and to researchers to try to find these hardwired differences between men's brains and women's brains?
Yeah, I've thought a lot about that. That's a tough question. I think it's because gender is such a strong part of our identity, and it's something that, you know, we start labeling each other as boy or girl from even before we're born, certainly from the day we're born. Somebody said to me once, you know, it's interesting, in preschools, the teachers always say, okay, boys and girls, let's calm down or whatever. So we have this sense of gender it's very fundamental to our lives.
What worries you about the impact of that kind of reporting on hardwired differences between our brains?
Yeah, I mean, of course there are differences between men and women, right? And I certainly think a lot of people who have read some of my pieces on this have tried to say that I'm rejecting the idea that there are differences. But I think for me, we need to have more of an emphasis on whether those differences are meaningful and why those differences show up in the first place. So, you know, as to why they show up, like you said, we have this knee-jerk sense in the media, and I think just in the public too, that everything is, that any difference we find between a man and a woman is innate or hardwired. When actually there's a lot of cultural and environmental influences that are enormous and usually totally overlooked. So that's what I'd like to see more people talking about. And, you know, of course it's important because of the very well-documented and persistent biases against women in the workplace, in schools, and just in, you know, everyday lives.
Right. And wasn't this kind of science, I mean, I don't know how well-founded the current science is. You want us to be cautious. But in the past, brain differences have been used to try to enshrine things like racism.
Yeah. There were some studies from like more than a century ago measuring just the size of the frontal lobe of the brain, like taking postmortem tissue and claiming that the frontal lobe was smaller in the studies are so old, they called them Negroes, than in Caucasians. And the same comparison has been made between men and women because men's brains tend to be, on average, larger than women's brains. And so that must mean, of course, that men are smarter, men are better. And actually these differences, even though scientists have liked pinpointing them and talking about them, nobody mentions that the overlap is huge. So yes, on average, a man's brain is larger than a woman's brain. But if you just took a random brain and weighed it, you would not be able to tell by weighing it whether it was male or female or whether it came from a man or from a woman. We tend to focus on the differences, and I think that's because it's convenient and they tend to fit our stereotypes.
Some of the reporting, including I think some of the reporting that prompted you to write a piece about this, looks at connections in the brains between the left and the right side or the frontal cortex and other parts of the brain. From what we know about brains Is that set in stone from when we're born, or do we develop that based on what we do, the way we think, maybe the way people talk to us?
Yeah, so that study you mentioned from December, their bottom line finding was that men tend to have stronger connections within a given hemisphere, whereas women have stronger connections between the two hemispheres. And so the way they presented this in the study, and even more so the way the media presented it, was that, oh, that makes sense because women are so much better at multitasking and social behaviors, which you need these crosstalk between the hemispheres. And men are really good at spatial directions and map reading, where it's all about, you know, your motor skills and your perceptual skills. That study, it was a huge number of people, and they ranged in age from 8 years old, I think, was the youngest one, all the way up to, you know, mid-adulthood. And but the notion of hardwired implies that you're born with something, right, that it's innate. But the youngest person in this study was 8 years old. So even if the connectivity differences they found are real, there's no way to know whether all the men were born with those connections the way they are and women were born with them, or, which I find far more likely, is that they're the result of, you know, everything you've done in your life. Of course, the brain is very plastic, and especially connectivity, the connections between brain areas. There's been an explosion in neuroscience research in the last few decades showing just how malleable that is. And so, you know, we're treated as gendered beings. Boys are treated a certain way and girls are treated a certain way. And so over the years, it wouldn't be strange at all to me that would result in different connections if that study is true.
So an expectation of boys might lead them to practice that kind of brain behavior more, thus developing it. And that expectation of girls might lead them to practice a different kind of brain behavior. And that's what's showing up in the scan?
That could be. I mean, they haven't done the study to really look at that. You'd have to follow people from the time they're born. But just to give you some examples of how strong these cultural influences can be, there have been studies showing that it's very, very detailed looking at videotapes of mothers interacting with their children. And mothers tend to talk to girls more than they talk to boys. And so, you know, if from a very young age your mother is talking to you more than your brother, maybe it makes sense that you would end up being more verbal later on in life. And actually, there was a fantastic study from, I think it was like maybe a decade ago, where researchers looked at birth announcements in newspapers, and they just looked at the text of these little birth ads. And it showed that when the birth was a boy, a baby boy, parents used words like proud and strong. And when it was a girl, they used words like happy. So even before, or even at birth, or even before a child is born, we're already giving them a gender and thinking about them in a certain way.
Virginia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was science journalist Virginia Hughes.